We'll be joined shortly by Philip Hamburger. He is the author of Is Administrative Law Unlawful? Philip Hamburger is the Maurice and Hilda Friedman Professor of Law at Columbia Law School. He's the author of Law and Judicial Duty and Separation of Church and State. The book Is Administrative Law Unlawful? Deals with the rather thorny and contentious question of where does constitutional law begin and end, and where does constitutional law, which is, of course, law that is made by the U.S. Congress, Article 1, Section 8, become administrative law, and the balance between the two. Administrative law, I think, is defined by laws that are made by either judges, bureaucrats under the auspices of the executive branch, or by executive order. Philip, thanks for joining me this afternoon.
Thank you. Good to be here.
My pleasure. Your book deals with the question of administrative law, whether it is unlawful. Could you, first of all, define administrative law in the present usage?
Okay, thank you very much. Well, we talk about administrative law, particularly in law schools, of course, and that very name gives it a sense of legitimacy. It suggests that it really is a sort of law, but of course it isn't. The laws under our Constitution consist of the Constitution itself made by the people or statutes that are made by Congress. And nowhere in the Constitution does it mention executive commands or diktats or edicts. And it's that which mainly is the core of administrative power. Administrative power is what my book actually describes as extra-legal power or extra-legal lawmaking, in the sense that normally the government controls us through the laws. It uses the laws to command us, control us. And that's okay because these laws are made by our representatives and it comes in the form of law. Administrative power, however, is a curious thing because it doesn't apply to us through the law. It applies to us through other means. And that's why what most people call administrative law or administrative power, I think is more accurately described as extra-legal power, in the sense that it comes not through law, but through other mechanisms, through mere commands.
Would it also not therefore be true that under Articles 9 and 10 of the amendments, states reserve the right to also make law based upon their own state legislatures that are not specifically delineated to the federal government by the Constitution?
Yeah, that's right. We have a federal system, and the federal system means that the broadest sphere of power actually is in the states, in the state legislatures, and only limited enumerated powers have been given by the people to Congress. And so there's a sort of very specialized limited power in the federal government. That appears in Article 1, and also it's sort of backed up by the amendments you mentioned. Those limits on federal power have long since passed, I'm afraid. And unfortunately, these days, it's the states as well as the federal government engage in administrative authority and power.
Right, exactly, that there are these extra-legal laws. I want to talk a little bit about how this is actually implemented. And my understanding is that it's there are several aspects to it. First of all, of course, you've got judicial fiat, where we have judges making law from the bench, essentially interpreting the Constitution, whether it be state or federal, as if they're having a constitutional convention. And, in fact, there have been several federal Supreme Court justices who have even made reference to this, including Brennan. And Warren in the past. And that is that you get special interests that will increasingly go to the courts rather than to state legislatures or the Congress to get laws passed because that way they can have it done by command. The second aspect is the establishment of bureaucracies. And the bureaucracies are able to make laws. Of course, they call them something else. They call them mandates, regulations, I don't know, whatever they want to call it, but they are laws. And you have an example of that with the workplace discrimination laws that are made by the EEOC and many, many other areas. This goes back to the Lincoln administration and the founding of the Interstate Commerce Committee, ICC. but it's something that's proliferated in the 20th century, particularly starting in the 1930s. And then the third area is presidential directive. That is the use of executive orders to make laws, when in fact executive orders traditionally have dealt with either specific regulations pertaining to the executive branch or to ceremonial decrees, like President Washington in the first year in office declared a day of Thanksgiving and prayer, that being Thanksgiving. And President Grant made Christmas a legal holiday by executive order. But beyond that, you never had a situation where a president by executive order would make policy like immigration policy, which is what President Obama is now threatening to do. So are those the three areas that you would define administrative law?
I think that what you described nicely captures the full, much of the range of extralegal power. My book actually focuses merely on the second of yours, and I guess also the third, namely the use of power by the executive, be it the president or one of the departments or other agencies of the federal government, to control us not through laws but through their mere commands. And I suppose one could have, as you do, take an even broader view of it. But there's only so much you can do, even in a long book.
I know, and it's a very comprehensive book, by the way. Okay. Now, I had a guest on the other day that brought up questions in my mind that I specifically wanted to ask you about, and that was Cliven Bundy. He was the rancher who got in trouble when he came across the Bureau of Land Management basically confiscating his cattle. And I discovered in the course of conversation with him that this is a problem that's endemic in the Western states. It's not even an ideological question. You got liberals and conservatives who are concerned over the fact that the federal government in the Western states controls about two-thirds of the land surface and manages it and did not cede it to the states, which they had done in the Eastern states when they became states. Now, is this whole structure upheld by administrative law? And what is the legal basis for the federal government to be managing vast tracts of territory west of the Mississippi?
Right. So this is a very interesting problem, and it's complicated because the federal government owns the land. And at first glance, this would suggest it should have very considerable control over what's done over it and over the people who reside on it. Now, it's a little different from the administrative power I've been looking at because there, in the administrative power I've focused on in my book, is where the government, the executive, exerts direct control through its regulations, commanding one. In contrast, the Cliven Bundy situation, the federal land situation, is the sort of situation where the government gives benefits, sometimes, you know, gives money to universities and exerts control that way with conditions on the money, and sometimes, as in the West, it uses the sort of the gives the benefit of federal land to folks and then uses that as a mode of control by placing conditions on it. And that's really what the federal land problem is in the West. Now, although that's not the sort of administrative power that I've been focusing on here, it is a sort of extralegal power. The government is meant to control us through laws, and we should live in a republic in which we're governed through laws made by folks whom we elected, whether we win or lose the elections, at least the folks elected by the people. The federal land situation, and indeed all the instances, for example, in universities where the government gives money and then puts speech restrictions on it, are instances where the government is unable to pass a statute controlling us. So instead, they use this apparent gift or benefit of land or money to institute controls. And this is what in law is called an unconstitutional conditions problem. Now, not all conditions are unconstitutional, but this is not the way in which the government should be controlling our lives. It really is a sort of backhanded way of control. And the Supreme Court has not figured out really how to deal with this yet. And it really deserves more attention. I've written on it in an article.
Where does the government derive its claim to have the money, the resources to control that land? I mean, what did they do? How did they raise that?
Those funds. Territory.
What's the origin?
Right. Okay. So these are territories acquired by the government long ago, whether through conquest or by treaty. And the government, in that sense, owns the land. And so they do have a claim on the land. The traditional policy of the government, though, was to disperse the land, to get it into the hands of the people, whereas now the policy of the government is to control us through the land, and that's a different matter. So I don't want to defend... Go ahead.
Not at all, but Clavin Bundy makes the case that the government has the right to control the land under two conditions. Firstly, if it's a military matter. Secondly, if a territory is a territory as opposed to a state, like, for example, Washington, D.C., and most of the states in our unions were territories before they became states. But he claims that once a territory becomes a state with its own constitution, then those lands become the purview of the state, and the state legislatures and governors then have the authority to decide how the land is going to be disposed of, not the federal government.
Right. Now, that's an interesting argument, and I confess I have not dug into it to know whether it's right or wrong one way or another. So I don't have any position on this. I'd have to do a lot of research. I tend to, as you'll see from my book, I tend to dig into a topic and try to dig it through, and that's not one I've studied.
Okay. Now, the other issue, and this is a news-driven program, so I need to ask you as a constitutional expert issues with regard to legalities in the news. President Obama, as we speak, has authorized and is conducting bombing raids over Syria. Now, my understanding is that there has been no congressional consultation. There's been no congressional declaration of war, certainly, and that he is openly and bluntly stating that he is deriving his authority from the United Nations Security Council. To my way of thinking, this is an extra legal question because Article 1, Section 8, Clause 3 says that the Congress shall declare war. The president should go to Congress, ask for a declaration of war, and the Congress shall then declare war, and the president then, as the commander-in-chief, is empowered to conduct the war. That's what happened in 1941 when Franklin Roosevelt asked for and received a declaration of war against Japan. So where does President Obama derive this authority right now? Is this not an example of Thank you very much. We're discussing administrative law domestically primarily with Professor Philip Hamburger, the author of Is Administrative Law Unlawful? And we're joined by Andre Traversa, my partner at EpiQuest Media. Andre, please go ahead.
Hey, Professor Hamburger, thank you for being on the show.
Thank you.
I guess I have two questions for you. One is, when a department issues regulations, and I realize that Congress has created these departments and they technically oversee them, but when a department issues regulations that are not specifically part of written law, of the law that Congress has written, would you call that, is that part of what you're talking about when you talk about administrative law?
Right. So what Congress will do is it will pass an authorizing statute for, let's say, the FDA or the EPA, and will include all sorts of vague language and opportunities for departments or agencies to make determinations. And then the agencies will fill in the gaps, as it were. And all that gap filling is a form of extra legal lawmaking. Rather than have Congress write the laws, the agencies end up doing it. And they also, of course, exercise extra legal judicial power in adjudicating violations of these regulations. That's right.
Okay. No, kind of a related question. In Canada, we have things like human rights commissions, and some states have civil rights commissions that are called administrative law courts. Now, what exactly – I've never been clear on this. What exactly is an administrative law court? Who are the judges on it? Are they appointed judges that are appointed by the executive branch in those states, or how does that work?
Yeah, what are those things? And this is not to comment on the substance of the policies enforced by any of these groups, but just to understand how it's imposed. Ordinarily, Congress is to make the laws. We live in a republic, and an elected body should be making the laws. And then courts, which are the opposite of elected bodies, which are staffed by judges who are meant to be intellectually independent in their judgment, actually decide whether we're guilty of violating them. And that way we're fully protected because we participate in the making the laws and we have genuinely independent judges appointed through a complex process to decide cases with the assistance of a jury. Administrative power avoids all of this. It's a giant evasion. Administrative law is made, or so-called, is made by agencies that are not staffed by people we elect. They're anonymous bureaucrats who are sort of an elite that we really have little connection to and are influenced mostly by large corporations, not by individuals who elect them. And then we have administrative adjudication. These are called administrative courts, and they're said to be staffed by administrative judges or administrative law judges. But these judges are not nominated by the president and then confirmed by the Senate, as the Constitution stipulates. And their loyalties are not entirely to independence because they're attached to administrative regulations, and so they're not apt to find these unconstitutional. And they just make decisions, of course, without a jury. I thought we had a constitutional right to a jury, not only in criminal cases.
Well, we have that in family courts, too, unfortunately.
That's right. And, you know, there's something very interesting here. Family courts apply a sort of law that is drawn from the canon law, which in turn is derived from the civil law. And administrative power also is that heritage. It's a continental civilian tradition, which is antithetical to the common law tradition. And interestingly, family courts are notoriously ineffective and notoriously slow and cause a lot of disruption. So all the injustices that we're familiar with from, let's say, traffic court and family law court is simply writ large in federal agencies. That's right.
Wow.
It's depressing. It's as if the DMV was our model. Sorry, go ahead.
You say that family law is derived from canon law. Isn't that from the Catholic Church? I mean, isn't that mm-hmm. something that I suppose you could say it predates the Constitution?
Mm-hmm.
How could that work? I mean, I understand that, for example, the Magna Carta is still sort of the law of the land and that it predates the Constitution, but there's nothing in it that contradicts the Constitution. And you have that phenomena, in a sense, across the world. Napoleonic law is the undergirding of much of European law. Turkish law is the undergirding of Israeli law. You know, you've got systems and layers of law that existed before the sovereign nation became a state that continues to be put in place. But how is it that canon law became a predominant foundation for American family law?
Well, that's a long story. Essentially, in the Reformation, the church courts in England lost their authority. And then Anglican ecclesiastical courts began to take their place, and eventually this all became a foundation for statutorily established family law courts. And so these are a bit of an exception to our general assumptions. But what you said about layers, I think, is very important.
We'll have to take one brief break here.
Sure.
We'll be right back. Philip Hamburger is my guest. Thank you, sir.
Turn to a pre-constitutional mode of government. English kings, you know, Edward III or Henry VIII, were discontent to rule through the statutes and through the courts of law. And so they tried to bind their people through proclamations and tried to adjudicate their violations of these extra-legal rules in extra-legal courts. And the English Constitution in the 17th century rejected that, and the U.S. Constitution rejected this in the 18th century. And unfortunately, we've gone back to those pre-constitutional modes of government. And that's what really worries me. That's the heart of the book.
Right. In other words, we have a situation where if you've got settled law, so-called, which sort of, I guess it goes back to St. Thomas Aquinas' idea of just laws, or just wars, as he called it in his Theologica, that these sorts of laws are not actually derived from the consent of the governed, which was a concept that eventually was came about and was manifested in our Constitution, and that's the underlying principle of the American system of jurisprudence, consent
right.
of the governed.
Yeah,
so,
we live in a republic. Yeah, we live
That's
in a republic.
Right. A republic and not a democracy.
Right, and the nature of a republic is that the laws are made by an elected body, and that is the assumption that has disappeared. Now, of course, the defenders of administrative power will say, well, Congress oversees all of this, But that's actually a curious assumption. The assumption is that there are dangerous elements in society that need to be controlled. We therefore need expert agencies. And just as the, let's say, corporations are controlled by the agencies are controlled by Congress. But of course, it's not clear it just happens that way. Maybe it's actually the reverse, because administrative power, unfortunately, tends to be susceptible to influence by people with large lobbying firms and other modes of influence in Washington, not by voting. And so there's a risk often that corporations, especially the largest ones, actually tend to have more influence in regulations than vice versa. So, for example, the net neutrality rules were actually drafted by industry lobbyists, not by the agency. And then there's a risk that the agencies, in turn, actually have control over Congress rather than Congress controlling the agencies. Very often the agencies can, through their distribution of benefits or through their regulations and adjudications, can affect the districts of various congressmen. And so the congressmen are somewhat beholden to the agencies. So it may be, rather than Congress controlling agencies, which in turn control us, it may be that large corporations have undue influence over the agencies, because, of course, the agencies are not elected, and then the agencies actually can influence the congressmen, in which case the entire theory is backwards. And, of course, that's an empirical question.
You know, it's interesting. Yeah, I mean, we found out that what you're saying is absolutely true when you had the BP oil spill in the Gulf of Mexico, and we found out that the bureau that manages oil licensing is entirely run by directly and by apparently by consent of Congress by the oil companies who
right.
You know, who were able to manipulate when and how this platform got its license.
Right.
So,
and the entire system
of
licensing lends itself to this sort of danger, as you suggest. And BP oil is a good example of this. I don't want to pick on any one particular company, but the danger is that instead of having a law adopted by Congress, which states a general rule that we all must live by, the agencies control and have the discretion over particular instances of deviations from the rule.
Okay, we'll be right back. Please sit tight. Philip Hamburg is my guest. You bet. This is Administrative Law Unlawful.
A Truth Talk Defender.
Thank you very much. And my guest is Philip Hamburg, who is the author of Is Administrative Law Unlawful? We're talking about, in a sense, the origins of law shifting from the consent of the governed through elected officials serving in legislatures, whether it be Congress, whether it be state legislatures, whether it be city councils, to these unelected bureaucracies that are run by private interests. You know, there are many examples of this. I mean, on the national level, huge examples of this, of course, is the Federal Reserve System, which is a private consortium of banks that basically have been given a partnership authority by the federal government in 1913 to issue currency at interest to the federal government and regulate the value of our currency. I would argue in direct contradiction to the Constitution, which says that Congress shall coin money and regulate its value. And also, you know, you've got these other agencies, this recent development within the Department of Education called Common Core Curriculum. It's privately run by this, you know, this consortium of educrats and various companies and private foundations like the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation that are making policy with regard to the education of our children. You know, in a sense, we've ceded that power from our elected representatives, in that case, local school boards and states, to this unelected bureaucracy. What say you, Philip?
Well, yeah, there are layers of problems here, because once Congress lets go of the power to legislate, one place it can end up in is in the hands of the executive, and that's dangerous enough. But then there's another problem, which is when Congress shifts legislative power essentially to private bodies, so-called independent agencies. Now, some of these agencies are not really independent. They're partly under executive control. But many of them are not entirely executive, or at least have considerable private participation. And that's very odd. I had not known that under our Constitution, the rules by which we should live are made by others in the society. And curiously, many of these independent agencies are actually dominated by forces that are relatively powerful in the society, at which point it very much looks rather medieval, as if the government is simply shifting power from the weak to the powerful in society.
It becomes almost brutalistic. Okay, we're going to take one more break here. Apologize for that, Bill, and we'll be right back.
Most of us have pondered about the one universe.
Really too much to cover in one short hour. You've also written a book about the separation of church and state, which is interesting. Perhaps we could have you back on to discuss that. And in a nutshell, we're talking about how power has been transferred, and always the possibility of such power is transferable to unelected people, people who are not accountable, people who are not, we don't even know who they are. They are wielding legal power, not lawful power, legal power over the rest of us, both domestically and increasingly internationally. And that in that sense, we are losing control of our own lives and our destiny, wouldn't you say?
Well, there is a danger of that. And the, you know, it's the odd thing is one doesn't want to go too far and say that we live in a terrible society. It's a wonderful society in many ways. Yeah. But the risk is that as we lose a republic and create within it another system of government, one that reverts back to a pre-constitutional mode of governance, one that's more like royal government, there really is a danger that the whole society will be crushed under the weight of, and our freedom will be crushed under the weight of regulations. In science, which I'm particularly interested in, there's a danger that all our innovation is going to be slowed down as more and more of it gets into the hands of regulators, who often, although they claim they're experts, are actually rather behind the times in their science. It's as if the regulations want to, as if the regulations were imposing the science of 10, 20 years ago. And this is really very unfortunate. It will affect the lives of all of us.
We're ruled by experts, ruled by professionals.
Well, supposed experts. I don't want to concede too much to them.
Right. No, I agree. But it's sort of a trend that really began, I think, in the early part of the 20th century mm-hmm. with the development of a professional class of teachers and professors who, they sort of were able to derive certain governmental authority over first education and then other areas. And then, of course, you had in 1913 the setting up of the nonprofit foundations and the think tanks where very, very wealthy people could park their money and employ themselves and their friends, but also wield great influence over our society, how we live our life. And there's been since then this gradual transfer to these panels of experts, so-called, as you say. Andre, would you like to chime in?
Yeah, sure. I want to go back to the administrative law courts. So, again, I'm trying to understand, like, for example, back in New Mexico, you may not be familiar with this, but there was a civil rights commission there that ruled that it was discrimination for a business to deny a wedding cake, a bakery to deny a wedding cake, or I'm sorry, it was a photographer who didn't want to photograph a gay wedding. Okay, so this civil rights commission, who runs it? These the judges on it, are they actually real judges with real law degrees, or what? And who appoints them? I mean, are they appointed by the executive branch in the state, or how does that work?
So it varies from state to state, but the key point, as you suggested, is that these aren't real judges. Sometimes they have law degrees, sometimes they don't.
Really? So they're just called judges?
They're called administrative law judges or administrative judges.
Even though they may not actually be judges, they're being labeled as judges.
None of them are judges.
Are you serious?
Well, a judge, at least under federal law, is someone who is nominated by the president and confirmed by the Senate, and that simply is not the case for federal administrative law judges.
No, but in states, though.
In the states, each state has its own mode of appointing judges, but usually commissioners and other administrative judges are not actual judges.
Wow.
But that gets worse because, you know, our rights under the Bill of Rights in trials, it's not only to be tried with the due process of law in a court and with a real judge, but also, of course, to have a host of procedural protections, including juries. And juries in administrative proceedings.
That's right.
And the whole point of a jury is to have a non-government official, in fact, a non-official, mere members of the community decide one's case. And that's very important, both as a political protection and also to ensure that the law, when explained to the jury, is of a clarity and simplicity that we can all understand it. The law gets insanely complicated, however, when officials who are steeped in the rulemaking are the ones who decide what the law is and then who apply it, because they're not just drawn from the community. So we now have government officials applying the law to us instead of having individual members of the community deciding it.
By the way, you mentioned family courts. I'm not against the idea. In theory, I think there should be a way to resolve child custody disputes. But again, there need to be juries. Why aren't there juries?
Right. The problems with family courts are really rather depressing, I'm afraid.
Okay, we'll be right back to conclude. Philip Hamburg is my guest. Is administrative law unlawful?
You have a mortgage and a load of other debt. Wouldn't it be great if it all just went away? 9-year mortgage can change your life.
We paid off all of our bills.
All your debt, including your mortgage, in as little as 9 years?
We will have saved over $313,000 in interest payments.
Even have more money left over each month?
It lowered our monthly payments by a little over $500.
9-year mortgage.
Where have they been all of our life?
If you knew about something like that, you'd want to tell everybody.
Whenever I have a friend or someone that needs this service, I give them the number.
Hi, I'm Larry Ruff, president of 9-Year Mortgage. This is unlike anything you've ever seen before, and it will absolutely not harm your credit. Call for your free CD and learn how you can eliminate all of your debt, including your mortgage, much sooner than you ever dreamed possible. The more debt you have, the more we can help.
Call for your free CD now, 800-383-5310.
This works. Call the number.
Call now for your free CD, 800-383-5310, 800-383-5310.
Chuck Morse speaks.
Thank you very much, and Philip. Excellent, thank you, Andre.
No, that's pretty much about it. I just think that what you're telling me is amazing. I had no idea that these people weren't actually judges. That's just amazing to me, and that's really scary because it's very Orwellian. Yeah. It's the use of words that mean things that they aren't supposed to mean. You know.
Yeah, my reaction to all of this, it was a learning experience studying this, and my reaction has just been to be depressed. Our government has been transformed.
Well, there are a lot of things to get depressed about in this world, so.
True enough.
You know, we should, Philip, we should have you back to talk about what we as citizens can do.
I look forward to that.
Besides what we're doing right now. Yeah, I mean, right now we're doing our bit by, and I feel like I do that, by simply exposing the situation, educating people, educating myself, but I'd like to talk further about practical steps we could do as citizens that are reasonable and within the system to challenge this situation. So, Philip, again, I want to thank you for joining me this afternoon. My pleasure.
Thank you very much.
Andre, take care. You bet. Andre, briefly, tell us about EpiQuest Media.
Oh, sure. EpiQuest Media is a service that we offer to people if they want to get booked on much larger shows, nationally syndicated radio, television, print, online media. We have clients that we book on all these different outlets. So if you're interested, call 773-774-1583. We'll see you soon.
844-439-1391, 844-439-1391. It's a pleasure to welcome aboard Charlotte Isabit. She's the author of several books, including Back to Basics Reform, or OBE, Skinnerian International Curriculum. Charlotte, thanks for joining me this afternoon.
Well, thank you, Chuck, very much. It's good to be back. I mean, I hate to think how many years it's been since I've been on your show. I mean, we're all getting on, huh? I don't know.
We're at this thing. I don't know. I've been doing this now since the late 90s, so it's been probably about 15 years.
I thought it might have been even longer. I've been at it since the early 70s, if you can believe it. Mm-hmm. And
Charlotte, while we're on the topic, could you talk a little bit about how it is that you got involved in the study of American education and the U.S.-Soviet agreements and all of this fantastic stuff that you've revealed?
Well, I never planned on that. You know, I've been in the Foreign Service. And that might have helped a bit because I saw a lot. I lived in communist socialist countries, and I spent 20 years outside the country. And then when I came back, very naive about what was going on in the United States, I went into a school district in Maine, which was definitely a pilot for education change nationally. And I was just asking questions. I finally got elected after three times because the liberals, who all came from out of state, you know how they do. You live in Massachusetts, you know. Sure. They all were going to Camden, Maine, because it's so beautiful and et cetera. And they want to move out of Connecticut or wherever it is. But they want also to bring all the services they've had with them. So then the taxes all go up, and people have to. The Mainers had to get out of their property on the ocean and move to the backwoods, and that was my constituency that finally got me elected. The Mainers, huh? But then when they all moved out to the backwoods, I couldn't have been elected dog catcher because I was just sitting in the middle of a very leftist liberal community. And they hated my guts. And so I was, you know, sort of Pollyanna. I was on the school board. I was just asking questions like, you know, why can't we have Warner's Grammar? You know, we used to have that in school, wonderful grammar book. I said, we've got the books. I know they're somewhere around here. I've seen them. But it got down to the point where, you know, they really opposed me. I said, well, what about 5 minutes a day? Well, I did manage to get 5 minutes a day. And then I got rid of the horrible sex ed, which I think I told you earlier. The people, the good parents fighting Common Core, they have no idea how bad things were in the 70s, huh? Where we had a standard.
Oh, yeah,
with,
right.
You know, a standard for, it was 12th graders, fortunately, not kindergarten like you have now, but the 12th graders should know the three types of sexual intercourse, including with animals, huh? And so I always tell the parents who are fighting the wrong battle now, Common Core is not the battle, it's a diversion. I say, look, I give you $1 million if you can come up a worse standard than that. See, we've had this stuff for years, and they're being led to believe that this is the battle to fight, and no, it's not, because anything that's federally funded will always be federally controlled, no matter if they think they've won, right? So anyway, that's another story. But so I continue in Camden, and I get this phone call, very important, from a retired teacher, and she lives in the community, and she says, you know, I really like the stance you're taking on all the different things, you know, academics and, getting rid of all this touchy-feely garbage, you know, your family's old-fashioned, we're moving into a new world order, blah, blah, global. She said, you're absolutely right. And I said, well, I don't know, am I? I said, I'm just absolutely bewildered, if anything, absolutely, huh? And she said, nope, you're right. And she said, I've lived all over the world, taught all over the world. And she said, I want you to go for training. And I thought, what's that? And she said, well, you'll find out what it is. She said, it's entitled Innovations in Education. And the subtitle was A Change Agent's Guide. That was the book that we were given when I went to the training. She paid $100 for me to go, and that was a lot back then, you know. And I went, and there were about 40 really good people, teachers and principals there, and from my school district as well. And the facilitator was using a program that actually was interesting subsequently. When I got into the United States Department of Ed, into my office, which was the most important office in the world, Office of Educational Research and Improvement, USA, my office is the office that funded, and it was still funding when I got in there under Reagan, that very program that I was trained in the mid-70s by Ronald Havelock out of the University of Michigan, Ann Arbor. Oh, horrible, horrible program on how to get these dreadful programs that they knew were controversial into the schools. You know, sex ed, drug ed, death ed, you know, all the things with education hanging off the end of them.
Sure.
And without the, you know, without the community, you know, telling you to get lost, Well, so he trained. The thing that got me, you know, you asked me what happened. was when he was training us to identify the resistors in our community. And, you know, I thought, what? You know, I've been out of the country 20 years. Mm-hmm. I did not know that in the United States we had, you know, termites. That's a compliment, really. Poor termites, huh? Mm-hmm. We had communists infiltrated deeply into our system, especially education.
Let me just build on that a little bit, Charlotte, because what you're describing here is it explains a lot of the very strange things going on in our schools where people who have half a wit scratch their heads and wonder, really, why is it that our children are being taught graphic details in sex education? What is that supposed to do? Why is it that all of these other things go on? And you're pointing out the underlying agenda here and how not only how it exists, but also how it is strategically implemented in each community, depending on the conditions of that community. And you point out that these people are part of a communist agenda. Now, when you say communist agenda, I want you to elaborate a little bit on that. Do you mean like something, you're not saying it's run out of the Kremlin. I mean, it's more to do with kind of like the Eastern Seaboard liberal internationalist establishment that wants to create human resources out of children.
Let's take the Heritage Foundation, right? A lot of people think that's conservative. Mm-hmm. It isn't. It's Marxist. Huh? And I'll explain that. Now, both parties at the top, Republicans and Democrats at the top, have the same agenda. That's something people got to understand. You understand that because you probably read Quigley's book, mm-hmm. Tragedy and Hope. He says it right in there. Mm-hmm. So when you look at that, it is a communist agenda that they have. You have to remember, Wall Street funded the Bolshevik Revolution.
Sure.
There's a great resource on that.
By the way, let me just mention the late Anthony Sutton, Hoover Institute fellow. He wrote a series of books, one of which was Wall Street and the Bolsheviks, and the other one was Wall Street and Hitler. Absolutely.
Right. He was a very good friend of mine, and I gave him the works, all the research for his book on the order at Yale, because mm-hmm. I had the names, the members. I had the books because my father was a member, right?
Wow.
And I received them in the mail when my dad was sick. And at the same time, I was in touch with Sutton on Soviet affairs or something, and mm-hmm. he asked me if I knew anything about the order, and I lent him the books overnight, and he copied the names. And then he called me and said, this is it. He said, this is where it's coming from. All of a sudden, I see it. Because he had not been able mm-hmm. to figure it out. You know, you're talking about his other books. He was wondering where it came from. But anyway, so I was very close to Sutton on this stuff. But let's go back. I don't want to forget Heritage. I just came out and said Heritage is Marxist, huh? Well, people would say, what? Mm-hmm. You mean that wonderful organization that has an affiliate in every state that's going up against Common Core and helping the parents and helping us understand how awful the public education system is Marxist? Oh, yeah. Okay. You want to know why?
You bet. Yeah.
You know who drafted the North American Free Trade Agreement? The Heritage Foundation.
The Heritage. There you go.
Yes. And Karl Marx, that was his agenda. That was Karl Marx's agenda, free trade.
It's this informal international control by sort of a consortium of private-oriented groups that would wield influence on the public sector. The public sector would be sort of the people who would stand out in the front. And that's a trend. I mean, that I think it's undeniable that it exists, because if we take a look, and your specialty, of course, is education. If we take a look at what's happened to American education, particularly since John Dewey and the socialist so-called forward thinkers, you see a transfer of educational authority from the elected local school boards mm-hmm. who are elected by the parents and by the community, who usually are parents and who know what's going on in school. You see a transfer of that authority to these unelected, essentially private consortiums. I mean, Common Core is just the tip of the iceberg, and that's absolutely a private thing. We could go back to the OBE. We could go back to outcomes-based, you know, the Centennial Project. I mean, it goes way back. And this idea is basically it's kind of a collusion between big business and socialists. The big business, they want to have people, they want a pliable workforce, people who are not going to question authority, people who could be fit into a peg and punch a time clock, what they call human resources. And, of course, the socialists, they want to have the international one-world ant colony,
That's right.
Everyone has been semi-lobotomized and people are basically, you know, from each according to his ability to each according to his needs. And
they've kind of
formed an unholy alliance.
Yes, but Common Core, I just have to go back. Common Core is not private. A Common Core is federally funded right down the line. It started with a national assessment, which is Carnegie. Again, they started that in 1969. Common Core is not private. They're telling people that, you know, for instance, the chief state school officers is private, and the National, you know, Governors Association, they tell that's the biggest lie. I know it because I worked in the U.S. Department of Ed. I know that all these outfits are getting federal money. And if you get federal money, you have federal control. But let's go back to where it all started. It started probably a bit earlier. I think it started in 1906 when Carnegie funded the National Governors Association, right? That was very important. Mm-hmm. But in 1934, this is the smoking gun. Carnegie, it was a study that was done on the social studies, and I have a little book. It's at my son's website. People can go there. If it's the most important thing they have to do is go to AmericanDeception.com for the study. We can pick up after the break.
Chuck Morse speaks.
Thank you very much. We're back. Charlotte Isabitz, my guest. The book is The Deliberate Dumbing Down of America. She's got an abridged and revised edition available at Amazon.com. Also the book Back to Basics Reform, or OBE, Skinnerian International Curriculum. Charlotte, we're giving a little background on how this all came about, this sort of collusion between big business, as represented by the Carnegies and the Rockefellers, who wanted to create a pliable workforce, and left-wingers like John Dewey and the so-called frontier thinkers who had some goosey idea about creating an international beehive, creating a one-world order where everyone would be absolutely equal. Both sides understood that in order to accomplish their unnatural goals, they would have to almost reconnoiter the brains of our young by removing moral codes of ethics, by removing belief in the creator of the universe, by removing the father-headed family as the authority in their life, and replacing that with the state. And that's exactly what they've attempted to do. They have succeeded in certain areas.
They have succeeded, you know, with this very highly. That's why, you know, a lot of our young people, it's great. They're fighting it. The younger people are the best that we've got right now fighting the system because they're the closest to having gone through it. And I have proof in my book, for instance, that I finally got it after seeing all these terrible programs that were being used in our children, federally funded, out of my office. Subsequently, the office that I went into was where they all came from, right, that I've been fighting. But I have the proof from the guidance counselors. That's in my big book, Deliberate Dumbing Down, where they say that they, on death education, they do a special issue on death education, the guidance counselors. And they say, we will use death education to change the students' attitudes and values towards death and dying the same way we used sex education to change their attitudes and values towards sex and various sexual practices. So that is the proof for any parent that when they see anything with education hanging off the end of it, coming out of their school, they should go and complain and say, no, we don't want it. Because the goal has not to help the students or the parents in any way or to keep them off drugs. It was to do just the opposite. Now, let me go back, though, to Carnegie, because that's the smoking gun. I don't want to forget it. And people can go and read it themselves. They can read the actual book, hand-scanned, into my son's website, AmericanDeception.com. That You just go to AmericanDeception.com and type the word conclusions into the search engine, and it will pop up. It's about a 200-page small book. And in it, Carnegie calls for using the schools to change America's capitalist economic system to a planned economy. And it calls for taking our land. And people could say, oh, you know, she's just talking 1934. Well, all I can say is that every 5 years, Carnegie put money into the national assessment, which the Common Core people don't even look at. They never want to go back to history. These neocon people who are running the show fight Common Core. They don't ever mention any history. And, of course, they're the very groups that have boycotted everything I've ever written since I got myself fired from the Department of Ed for leaking a technology grant. Every single thing I have written has been boycotted across the board by these groups. They do not want, they can talk all they want about wanting to have good standards for history in the public schools. What a joke. But they don't want anybody to go near the history of American education because the people are going to find out that the neoconservative Trotskyites, that's what they are, these groups out there, they're all fighting Common Core, the diversion. People could say diversion from what? Diversion from the big issue, school choice. Tax-funded school choice with unelected boards, essential for the Soviet polytech workforce training system. That is exactly what they don't want parents to fight, because they have to have the school to work to spin off profits for the global elite. Use your children to do that. And I'm not kidding. I have right in front of me something from the National Alliance of Business. And boy, Grandpa and Grandma, if you're listening to me, you better believe it when I tell you what they're calling for. It says right at the top of the letterhead, kindergarten, this is training, mind you, through age 80.
Cradle to the grave.
Yes. And the community ed and all these schools being put in with all the services, you know, health ed, drug ed, abortion clinics, they're going to have euthanasia later, too. This has all been planned, and I have all the documents. It's womb to tomb, but it cannot go in without, guess what? Guess what it can't go in without?
What's that?
School choice.
Without, all right. So then you have the children locked in these prisons every day from the earliest of age, and then they're indoctrinated. We'll be right back.
And learn how you can eliminate all of your debt, including your mortgage, much sooner than you ever dreamed possible.
Thank you very much. And Charlotte Isabitz, my guest. We're doing a little background here on how it is that our young people are now trapped in these institutions, and that the Common Core really is only a symptom of a bigger problem, which is this this concept that we could look back to the works of Karl Marx. We could go back to the French Revolution. I mean, it's a trend that goes back to, I would argue, the Garden of Eden. I mean, this is nothing new. And this idea that that human beings ought to be controlled by superior human beings who are so-called enlightened and who know better than we do what's best for our own lives. And this transfer of power, I mean, the very purpose, the very essence of America was supposed to get away from that, was supposed to essentially place government in the hands of people who represent us, and a limited grant of that government at that. Instead, we have the transfer back to this authoritarian, top-heavy system by which people who feel entitled to control the world are manipulating all of us, and starting with our children. And Charlotte worked in the Reagan administration. She got an inside glimpse in terms of how this actually works. She's exposed it in very important books. Charlotte, so we're talking about this, how this is now being implemented. And my sense is that things are picking up rapidly, especially during the Obama administration. When you have open,
people can blame him. I blame him. I can't stand him. But it's not Obama. The agenda coming through right now was institutionalized. That means it's been planned, you know, since 1934 with Carnegie, right? But institutionalized under President Reagan. It was my office. And everything going in right now, whether it's the public-private partnerships that Reagan started in the White House, I was the liaison with the White House on that devastating initiative. See, the best you can call it is corporate fascism under Reagan. Then the school choice agenda, which is lethal, because the only school choice that is valid is when you pay. When you don't pay, that's no choice because you're just getting federal curriculum, no matter what, right? The school-to-work agenda was under Reagan. That's the Soviet polytech system. The Skinner method, institutionalized under Reagan. It was experimented with on the minorities, you know, the mastery learning, the direct instruction. All conservatives love direct instruction. They know it's necessary for school-to-work. That's Skinner. But, you know, that they experimented with minorities with direct instruction from 1965 on. Tremendous catastrophe for the minorities, and now all our children are going to get it, are getting it, because you have to have that for school to work. That's Skinner, where you can measure everything. Mm-hmm. Everything's measurable, has to be. You know, no God. It destroys the soul. It destroys the conscience. That's going in supported by the neoconservatives. They came out last week, believe it or not. I couldn't believe it after my fighting this for 3 years, and then boycotting everything I've written about it and saying Charlotte's wrong, direct instruction is not Skinner. The Heartland Institute, one of the leading neocon groups, came out saying we've got to use the Skinner method. And they've got even wrote a book on it called Rewards. You can get it at Amazon. They came out supporting the Skinner method. Well, they are just what I told you. They support what Carnegie was calling for, a planned economy. These are the people, and you don't hear much from the left about it. You do hear from them. They're pushing this agenda, and the only way it could go in is if every single part of the curriculum is dog training. Because, you know, they're not going to be educated. They're going to be trained. And so it's Pavlov and it's Skinner. And we have all the documents. They're all in my book, Deliberate Dumbing Down. And, yeah, I know people can't get the original because it's out of print. But they can get the updated version at Amazon. But the updated version is very valuable because it covers from, you know, from 2000 to 2000.
Thank you very much. Charlotte Isabitz, my guest of the Deliberate Dumbing Down of America. Charlotte, would you take a minute and describe for my listeners exactly what Skinnerian education is and who was B.F. Skinner and what was his influence?
15 years ago, and I don't Skinner. Mm-hmm. I don't believe that he ever dreamed that the method of dog training. That's really what it is. Operant conditioning is dog training. I mean, your listeners, most of them probably, you know, they may not understand that term, but they understand how their dog operates. You know, I mean, if you want your dog to do something, you give them a dog biscuit. If you want a student to do something, you give them a reward. And if they don't do something, they don't use the penalties that much, but they do sometimes. You penalize them. It's very, very simple. You can read thousands of books on operant conditioning. It's a fascinating field. Pavlov actually started it, and interestingly enough, Pavlov studied under Wilhelm Wundt, who was the originator of it in Leipzig, but. It's very simple. Just think of it in terms of your dog or if you have animals. And some dogs are really rather resistant. I have a dachshund who really does not like that very much. But that's what they're doing with our children. And they say it works. Yes, it works to a point, but that's not real learning. That's training. It's like a conductor with an orchestra. He's conducting, and the audience just does what he directly tells them what to do. There's no thought going into anything. This is not education. C.S. Lewis really put it well, although he didn't mention it as operant conditioning. He said, when training, which is what's going in right now with a computer, is necessary for Skinner's box, when training beats education, civilization dies. And, that's true. And, I hope people will remember that quote. And the thing is that right now, as I said, the conservatives, the neoconservatives, are supporting the use of Skinner. They've come out. They've admitted it. Although they told everybody I was wrong for 30 years, they're now admitting it. Very important, parents. Hey. Shop, do not... Peaks.
Thank you very much. Charlotte Elizabeth's my guest, A Deliberate Dumbing Down of America. You can get the revised and abridged edition on Amazon, Amazon.com. Also, Back to Basics Reform, or OBE, Skinnerian International Curriculum. Charlotte, what do we tell parents who have their children in public schools in terms of practical things that they can do now to try to at least protect their children from some of the worst of this?
Well, I think, first of all, they've got to understand that abandoning the public schools is the most dangerous thing they can possibly do. And the reason I say that, I mean, of all people, you know, because I've pointed out more than anybody else the devastating curriculum, damaging curriculum in the public schools. But the public schools have elected school boards. And we cannot allow the people pushing for school choice, which isn't school choice, got to understand that. Any school choice that is tax-funded is public education.
Right.
It's going to be controlled by the federal and at the federal and international level. School choice has been asked for. It came from the left. UNESCO called for it in 1972. You cannot have a global system for workforce training without school choice. That's how they're going to suck in all the parents from private, religious, Catholic. All schools will be, children and adults, because it's lifelong, will be sucked in under school choice. So you have to stick very much with and support the present public school system. And I don't believe that all public schools are as rotten as the neoconservatives are telling you right now. There are plenty of good teachers still out there. Now, I know that we are between a rock and a hard place. And the rock, which is lethal, is the tax-funded school choice. And now listen to me, folks, supported by guess who? Obama, the U.S. Department of Education, the neoconservatives, Gerstner, IBM, who calls for destroying all 16,000 school districts, and the Council on Foreign Relations. I guess I mentioned that, Rockefeller. That they support school choice. Now, you better wonder, how come they can all be together there? That's option one, lethal. That is lifelong dictatorship, world government. School under school choice. The other option is difficult as can be, but you've got to hold on to the public school system, become more involved, run for office, speak out, talk to teachers, and demand, and I mean demand underscored a billion times, that the U.S. Department of Education be abolished, that your State Department of Education be abolished, that Health and Human Services and Labor be not allowed to ever pour any money into your local school district, because that's the lifelong learning under the umbrella of the school district that they're setting up right now all across the country. So that you have to demand that, go back to pre-1965 academic education. That is the only solution. Now, let me point one thing out. You know who's heading the school choice agenda, Chuck? New Orleans. The ex-vice president of the Carnegie Foundation for the Advancement of Teaching that had all the agreements with the Soviet Union, Academy of Science, in 1985, same time Reagan merged our two systems together, right?
Right.
Lyon.
Isn't that also where Common Core comes out of?
What's that?
Yep.
That, yes.
Common Core is coming out of there, too.
John Ayers at Tulane University is heading up. He's a brother of the communist Bill Ayers, the building bomber with Weathermen, huh? He's heading up the school choice agenda out of New Orleans at the national and international level. He's also heading up the lifelong community service schools under unelected boards across the world. Now, I want to ask the people out there who are allowing the Heritage Foundation and all these groups to dictate to them in regard to going up against Common Core and having school choice. what the heck are, why don't you ask the leadership, hey, don't you have a problem with John Ayers heading up your agenda for school choice? Carnegie
Interesting. I mean, you know, it's what a fraud.
Oh, that's a good question.
Sham.
Hey, for parents out there.
Yeah.
That where's Phyllis Schlafly? Where are the Birchers? Where is Heritage Foundation? Where's Jim DeMint? Where's Freedom Works and all? Aren't they upset having a commie heading up the school choice agenda?
Actually, where are they now that you mention it?
Oh,
I mean,
no,
these are good,
you don't hear a word from
people.
Them. And since we started our marvelous blog, the ABCs of Dumbdown, blogspot.com, we're bringing all this information out. We're identifying these neoconservatives one by one. It's like in a shooting gallery. We're knocking them off with their own words.
All right. We'll be right back.
On the Information Radio Network.
Thank you very much, Charlotte Elizabeth. I want to thank you for joining me this afternoon. We should do it again soon. You know, it's really quite breathtaking if you think about this, that we've got all these good patriotic people. Are they just simply deceived, or are they part of the problem?
Oh, I think the majority of Americans, it's tragic, are good people, and they have the same view as we do, Chuck. But they've been deceived by these neoconservative groups. And we identify all of them in the Exposing the Global Road to Ruin through Education disc set. That's at Amazon. People really ought to go there. There's one disc that identifies all of the groups, and the person doing it has been studying them for 40 years. That's Kelly Nelson. And it's
sure.
Incredible. And so, you know, what I say is we're at war for the minds and souls of our children, for their lives. And you know what? You can't win a war. You have to first identify the enemy. Who's the enemy? It's the neoconservatives right now. We've always had the left to worry about. They're there. But it's the neoconservatives. They're the enemy. And then you have to have ammunition, don't you? Can't win without it. And the ammunition is all of my books, all have been boycotted by the neoconservatives, but they are available. And The Big Baby, by the way, is out of print, but it's a free download. The Big Baby is a free download at deliberatedumbingdown.com. Mm-hmm. And you can cut and paste everything in there and send it to all of your friends who are parents. And this is the documentation that I'm talking about today that you can get out to all your friends and parents and ministers. And businessmen, I'm sure they're local businessmen, Main Street. They don't want any part of this lifelong, you know, we call it limited learning for lifelong labor.
You know, the thing I like about your book, Charlotte, is you've got all the documents there which you took out of the Department of Education back in the 1980s, and it's just there. I mean, it's irrefutable. So
yeah,
I urge people to check this out.
You know, Chuck, that's why I feel so badly that the American people have not been allowed to have this information. We've done what we can to get it out. And, of course, the book is,
that's right.
You know, it's third printing and back to basics. It's all they needed. But that's now...
We are now completely debt-free, and we will never be in the spot we were again, thanks to Trinity.
If your debt has you down, call Trinity at 1-800-793-8752.
My name is John.
I'm Vicki.
And I'm Emma.
And we're debt-free for keeps.
That's 1-800-793-8752.